This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So you're saying that I'm like right now on the... Yeah, okay, cool. Hey.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Wa qala alladhi ishtarahu min misra limra'atihi akrimi mathwahu asa an yanfa'ana aw nattakhidhahu walada. كذلك مكنا ليوسف في الأرض ولنعلمه من تأويل الأحاديث والله غالب على أمره ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون
رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي فالحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين أما بعد. Once again, everybody, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Today, we're going to try to talk about ayah number 21 of Surah Yusuf. And this is the first scene that we're getting of the new home that he's going to find himself in, where he's going to be for a few years. It's important to note that if you pay attention to the life story of Yusuf alayhi salam, everybody knows the major kind of milestone events in his life. It seems that in the early part of his life, he never really has a permanent home. So he's there someplace for a few years, then going to a completely different life. Then he's in a completely different life inside where he's going to find himself in Egypt. And there's going to be a completely different life inside the prison. And each one of those phases is almost disconnected from the other. It's a new, you know, kind of life altogether. So in that sense, it is a new life that's starting for him as he moves to Egypt. So yesterday, what I mentioned to you is that he was being passed along from, you know, from as bida'a. Bida'a means something you hold on to so you can sell it, right? So as he's being passed along, everybody who's buying him is buying him so they can sell him again at a profit. And so he's going from slave trader to slave trader to slave trader and moving along like that. And that chain comes to an end when finally he makes it to a market in Egypt, right? So it's not like he, you know, it's not just that the man who purchased him is from Egypt, but finally he ended up in Egypt where the sale is taking place. وَقَالِ الَّذِي اشْتَرَاهُ مِن مِصْرَ لِمْرَأَتِي. So now we're getting to the person who bought him. And Allah did not give us his name. He simply gave us a title for him later on, and that is Al-Aziz, which means the minister, but we're not even getting that yet. So we're not getting what his role is in society. That's going to come a little bit later on. What Allah's attention is, wants our attention on right now, is that the one who purchased him from Egypt. Now the literal phrase is the one who purchased him from Egypt. Now this could mean a couple of things. One thing it could mean is that the person is from Egypt. So the one from Egypt purchased him, right? So whoever purchased him is a person belonging to Egypt. It can also mean finally from Egypt, meaning from the marketplace in Egypt is where the man purchased him, right? So, and the word from is also interesting because you would imagine وَقَالَ الَّذِي اشْتَرَاهُ بِمِصْرَ, like the one who purchased him, you know, in Egypt or at the location in Egypt. But the word from is important because he was being sold from one place to another place, then from one place to another place, then from one place to another place. And the place from which this product, if you will, was bought by this man was from the marketplace in Egypt. Okay, so that's where we find ourselves now. وَقَالَ الَّذِي اشْتَرَاهُ مِن مِصْرَ. It's also important that we know that the story began in the land of Canaan, or Kan'an in Arabic, and that location hasn't been mentioned in the Quran. That geographic location is not of significance to be mentioned. The Bible mentions it. The Bible even mentions the outskirts where they went to is Shechem, and then Dothan further out, on out. So it names all the locations. But the Quran doesn't do that. The Quran only mentions one location here, and that's Egypt. And that's because that is of pivotal importance. Also because the question asked of the Prophet ﷺ was, how did the Israelites end up in Egypt? It's also important that the Quran, in a universal sense, because the Quran's not there just to answer the questions of the Israelites who were poking at the Prophet ﷺ and try to prod him to see if they can stump him or one-up him that he didn't come up with an answer. The Quran is revelation for all times and all nations. So it's incorrect to almost think that the primary concern of the Quran is just to answer a group of people that were trying to criticize the Prophet ﷺ, because then that limits the relevance of the Quran to a very small group, not for all of humanity. The thing is, Egypt is of central importance in the message of the Quran.
understanding what happened in Egypt is two nations. There's two nations that are of significance. There's the pharaohs who rise to power, and then the psychology of the pharaoh, because the pharaoh is a pretty big deal in the Quran. The Fir'aun, by name, you don't find, you know, individuals being called out, individuals that stand against Allah being called out in the Quran the way that the Fir'aun is called out. Yes, Qarun is mentioned. Yes, a few other villainous characters are mentioned. But no one like Fir'aun. And Fir'aun obviously has the position that he has because of Egypt. أَلَيْسَ لِي مُلْكُ مِصْرَ. You know? And so the country name Egypt keeps coming up over and over and over again. And that civilization keeps getting mentioned by Allah over and over and over again. Because there are two nations of significant importance for the purpose of everybody's guidance that we must learn from. One is the Israelites, and anybody who studies Quran seriously knows that the children of Israel and Israelite history and the Israelite prophets and the journey of the Israelites, you know, from the very beginning and actually chronologically starting here, is a pretty big deal in the Quran. That's a pretty big subject. And on the other side, it's the Pharaoh and his mindset and the reason he believed him to be godlike, because or God himself, because of the empire that he controlled under his feet. And that's Egypt. So these two, the pharaohs and the Israelites, are actually what you can call, the big word is, and some of you kids are watching and stuff, they're called archetypes. Archetypes means you study some people or you study a case, but you're not only learning about them, you're learning that their behavior is done by lots of other people too. So you're learning by their example. So the Fir'aun doesn't just represent himself in the Quran, Fir'aun represents anybody who acts the way that he does. Even if they don't have a pyramid, even if they don't have a sphinx, even if they don't call themselves God, they can act like him. The Israelites don't just represent themselves, they represent the kind of behavior that they engaged in. So these two, the pharaohs and the Israelites, are actually pretty important archetypes in the Quran. Which is why, of the many nations, of the countless prophets and the countless nations that Allah has given guidance to, and Allah has knowledge of the map of this world better than anyone else, because He has the map of the seven skies and everything that's ever been created. No one knows these places better than He does. And yet, the place of the well is just some land. It's just some ditch. You know, Ibrahim alayhi salam is just making hijrah and he's just being thrown into a fire. We're not told where this fire is and what's going on. The specifics aren't mentioned. Where is the caravan taking him? What stops are they making? We don't know any of this stuff. We just know he ends up in Egypt. So the mention of Misr is important. Which is why in Quran studies, as was the case in biblical studies, in Quran studies, the study of Egypt on its own, the study of Egyptian history, the study of the rise of the Egyptian Empire and how the Quran comments on it, and the same way Israelite history, are of paramount importance. In fact, in my own studies of Quran, whenever I come to a story or part of the Quran that has to do with Israelite history or particularly Egyptian history, I go and try to learn something about Egyptian history and broaden my knowledge of these ancient people and what they believed and how their civilization was structured. Why is it so important? And the other, I'll further a comment that I made to you guys yesterday. It occurred to me today while driving back from a grocery store. Yep, I do groceries too. So when I was driving back from a grocery store, it occurred to me, I told you yesterday, that the value of human life cannot be judged by what you see, right? And here you have a child that's riddled in mud inside of a ditch in the middle of nowhere that's being pulled up, not by the authorities or anybody else, but by water fetchers who are going to treat him like a commodity to sell, right? But if you fast forward a little bit, Yusuf alayhi salam is actually the precursor, the reason for which the Egyptian nation was and the kings were actually able to rise to power. Had it not been for the economic collapse that was looming, that was avoided by Yusuf alayhi salam and his ingenious interpretation and his revealed guidance, and his know-how of how to deal with that crisis. So it wasn't just about interpreting the dream, but it was also about expertise that was needed, which we'll come to today a little bit. Had it not been for that, the Egyptians would not have risen to power. And had they not risen to power, then they wouldn't have kept on growing in power until they became the pharaohs of the time of Musa alayhi salam, and the great pharaohs that left a mark on the planet. To this day, I don't have cash with me right now. I'd pull out a dollar bill and show you the pyramid on top of the dollar, on the dollar bill. What's it doing there? That pyramid wouldn't have been there if that boy wasn't pulled out of the well. Like, think about that for a second. Like, what a What a serious chain of events that is. Talk about a butterfly effect, you know? Now, think of it this way. If you do your own search, I'm encouraging you to do your own. Everybody's got a phone or ability to Google something or whatever, unless you're in China. I don't know what you don't do Google, so I don't know what you do. But if you search modern architecture or global architecture inspired by ancient Egypt, just do your own search. Just look into how much of what the world looks like, what government buildings look like, what museums look like, what modern design looks like, how much of it came as an impression made by the ancient Egyptians. It's remarkable. It's incredible how much of it is actually going back to the ancient Egyptians because the world was so impressed by what they accomplished. وَيَذْهَبَ بِطَرِيقَتِكُمُ الْمُثْلَى. But anyway, this is the story that actually in a very real sense impacted the entire world. It impacted how the world functions. You know, one part of my reading in ancient Egypt was that, you know, the royalties of different nations, like the Chinese or the Greeks or whoever else, to send their royal princes and princesses for higher education, they used to send them to Egypt, in ancient Egypt. Like that was like the international university spot. And this is also important, and it'll play a role in what I'm going to share with you today. وَقَالَ الَّذِي اشْتَرَاهُ مِنْ مِصْرَ. And the one who purchased him from Egypt said, لِمْرَأَتِهِ. He said to his wife, أَكْرِمِي مَثْوَاهُ. Now, so he's already purchased him. Obviously, now mentioning that he said it to his wife means he's not buying him to sell him again. He's buying him to bring him home. So he's bought this young boy now, and he's bringing him home. Now, this idea of him bringing him home seems, even that brief encounter of purchasing him, he's noticed something in Yusuf that he doesn't see in other slaves. He's a perceptive man, right? And you can, later on we know he's a politician, and politicians size people up all the time, right? And they have to deal with people, and politicians will always have trust issues. They don't know who to, because they have very sensitive data they have to, their personal life can be politicized in some way, right? Or what goes on inside the house can actually, if it's leaked, it can actually lead to their ruin, right? To this day that happens. So if he's going to buy a slave that he's going to bring to the house, he's going to have to look for certain markers. So he, in whatever way that he can perceive, he sees that this is not a slave, like born into slavery. This young man is pretty refined, he's classy. Not only does he look good, as Quran will, you know, illustrate later on, he's a good-looking kid, but he's also very refined in the way he carries himself, is very dignified, not like a slave. So he's impressed already with whatever he's noticed of Yusuf alayhi salam. It's interesting that he's met a stranger and he's impressed with him, which is again a parallel with the story of Musa alayhi salam, because those two women at the water met a stranger, Musa, with a very brief encounter, and they're impressed with him. And then they go home and they speak well of him, right? And he's going to go home and speak well of Yusuf alayhi salam after this brief encounter. He's bringing him, and they requested to bring him, and he's literally bringing him. There's another interesting contrast. When the baby was found in Egypt, Musa alayhi salam, the queen requested the king, the pharaoh, can we keep him, right? And she said, he's going to cool my eye, asa yanfa'ana, maybe we could keep him as a servant, maybe he could benefit us, or we could, you know, take him as our own child, we could adopt him. She requested. She can't tell the pharaoh what to do. She can only beg or plead or request, right? Put in a word. But this is the head of the household. He's going to say the same words. Maybe he could benefit us, we could keep him as our own child. Those words are coming, we'll analyze those. But he's not coming and asking his wife, he's telling his wife. He's coming home and telling her, listen. And you can tell he's taking an authoritative tone. Why? Because the first things he says is, very interesting, أَكْرِمِي مَثْوَاهُ. Honor, I'll give you the shallow translation first, honor his residence. Honor his residence. Now, ikram as a verb is also used for, as a common expression in ancient Arabic and even contemporary Arabic, ikram al-dayf. It's used for honoring the guest. So when you provide a guest a comfortable house, you know, seating in the living room, and you serve them something or whatever, that's also a kind of ikram that you do, right? So he's already talking about Yusuf alayhi salam. One implication of this is he's talking about him as if he is an honored guest in the house, which is odd because he's actually a slave, right? So he's already developed a kind of respect for him, that he's talking about him in this noble term. And so as he introduces him to his wife, he says, honor our guest. And you can tell when he's saying that, even Yusuf alayhi salam must be like, wait, what? Because he's coming from an experience where he's being treated like an animal, right? And all of a sudden, the owner of the house is speaking of him in such high terms. The last lecture, I told you I'm not impressed with the slave owner because he's kind to him. Yes, his kindness will come through. That is going to come through. But it's not that impressive of a kindness. But at least for a child, it's a breather, isn't it? At whatever little it is, it's a breather from what he's coming from. And the fact that not only is he treating him kindly, it could be that you treat someone kindly, but as soon as you come home, no, I got to act like the boss now. So you were so nice to me in the car. Why are you being so mean? Because you got to keep up appearances in front of somebody else. So sometimes people are two-faced towards you. Right, in private, they'll come to you and say, I'm really sorry the way I spoke to you. I was so mean. I don't mean to be like that. But you know, it's just, I'm under a lot of pressure. And then when they come in front of other people, then they act all tough and they even bully you and talk to you. And you're looking at them like, you're the same person? How are you doing that? I've actually experienced some of this in my life. People that are like your dearest friend in a private conversation. And then outside, they're a completely different person. Complete, you wouldn't even recognize. And then you're privately talking to them again saying, what was that? I'm sorry, I can't explain. I'm so scared. Oh, okay. All right. Whatever it is. It's all good. You stay scared. I'll talk to you later. Or not. But apparently he's not only kind to Yusuf alayhi salam on the ride, but he's maintaining that posture when he comes home. And he tells his wife, honor his housing. Now the other interesting thing, a slave in society is the most unhonorable, dishonorable role a human being can have. I mean, they're being treated like a thing, not even a person. At best, an animal. That's how they're being treated. So the word honor doesn't really go with that, does it? And it seems that he is, the first thing he's concerned with is not going and taking Yusuf to a nice room in the house. Hey, this is your room. This is where I want you to stay. You're going to be fine. I'll take care of you. He's concerned that there's someone in the house who's going to treat him like an animal. And I need to make sure that doesn't happen when I turn my back. Because I'm going to go back to the office. I'm going to go to the governor's mansion. Or I'm going to go to this meeting. I'm not going to be at home. Who's going to be at home? The wife. And she's going to treat him by her own standards. And he knows that his way of thinking is not the same as her way of thinking. So he's actually setting the rules down. You are the queen of the house when it comes to everything else. But when it comes to him, you're going to show some respect. So even as a kid, he's telling her, you're not going to treat him like you treat everybody else. You better honor his housing. You better honor his residence. It could also imply mathwa. Interestingly, mathwa is a few things. It can mean an infinitive noun meaning residence itself. Or his housing. Honor his housing, meaning make sure that he has a comfortable place to sleep, decent food, he has privacy to himself. You know, don't treat him like others and just toss him around or, you know, wherever, sleep outside, I don't care. Make sure you give him proper, you know, treat him properly. But mathwa can also be a dharf, and a dharf would mean that it's a time or a place. If it's a place, then it means respect his space. If we put him up in the room on the backyard, if there's a shed or there's a living quarters or whatever, she's the owner of the house. She can walk in anywhere. It's her house. If he's telling her respect his residence, means she can't just walk in on him. Respect his privacy. Respect his space. And also means dignify his space. So not just respect him yourself. Ikram can be to respect someone. It also means to ensure the dignity of someone. So ensure that his housing is respectable. I need you to make sure that he's taken care of well. Mathwa can also be the time of, you know, actually thuwiya in Arabic, the passive form, is also used for burial, to be buried. And it's maybe figurative expression for going to sleep, right? Because you bury yourself in your bed kind of thing, right? So he's also saying, honor his private times. Don't just treat him like whenever I ask, he better come here. No, let him get his rest. I've given him his hours. I've given him a schedule. He's going to abide by the schedule I laid down for him. And you better respect that too. And you better abide by that even in my absence. So he's kind of laying down some rules for his wife to not treat him a certain way. Akrimi mathwahu. Now there are some other side implications from the word thawa. Because you can say maskan for a residence. Mutabawwa, you can say for residence. There are lots of words, you know, baitahu, you can say for residence. So there are lots of words, darahu, you can use for residence. But the Quran in this particular case uses the word mathwa.
Abdurrahman Kilani, in his Mutaradifat al-Qur'an, which is a book of synonyms in the Qur'an in Urdu, he argues that thawa, the verb, is used for when someone lives somewhere where their ancestors are buried. Okay, so if you've been living there for a long time, your ancestors lived there, and their grandpa, and their grandpa, and their grandpa, this is your ancestral land, that's called your mathwa. Okay? And in that sense, in the Quran, for example, it's used for the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, وَمَا كُنْتَ ثَاوِيًا فِي أَهْلِ مَدْيَنَا. The ثَاوِيًا from the same origin. You weren't a resident of the people of Madian. You know, تَتْلُوا عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِنَا. That meaning, if you were living in Madian, and you had lived there for many generations, Austin, I can hear the crunching, it's melting my brain cells, and they're coming out of my nostrils. Okay, so, but you can eat that, just go a little further away so that the crunching doesn't, you know, do that to me. Okay, so what was I saying? Something about Islam? Thawiyan. The residents, yes. So you haven't lived in Madian for so many generations that you know their history so well, that was passed down from father to son to son to son to son to you. So the way that the Quran is giving you information about the ongoings of ancient Madian before they were destroyed makes it sound like that was your ancestral home. No, it wasn't. This is revelation. So the Quran uses that word for the Prophet ﷺ, making the claim that you're not from Madian, and yet look at the information you have about Madian, right? But mathwa is also used for another implication where you expect that your ancestors or future generations will be buried. And by implication, where will you live for generations to come? What's your long-term residence? You're not here temporarily. By literary extension, where you plan to stay permanently. And in that sense, even hellfire is called mathwa, bi'sa mathwa al-mutakabbirin, meaning what a terrible place where somebody will stay generation after generation after generation, meaning lifetimes they're going to stay there. That's the implication, right? So in that sense, when he says honor his mathwa, he may also be saying, I plan on keeping him for a really long time. And I plan on keeping him to the point where when he's old enough, he may even start a family and he may still be here. And his children may still be here. And by the word honor, it doesn't seem like he's planning on keeping him as a slave. He sees some kind of an investment here. There's something also else you should know about the ancient world. This is certainly true. I can't verify if this is true for the ancient Egyptians, but it's certainly true of the ancient Romans. And a lot of Roman practices do seep over from ancient Egypt. Because the next major power to come in the world after the fall, the slow fall of the Egyptians, was actually the rise of the Roman Empire. In the Roman Empire, the Caesars, they had two kinds of sons. So the Caesar has he's got his queen, they have a child, but the child, you know, is scrawny, or he's not that smart, or he's not that good at wielding a sword, or whatever. And they're like, I'm Caesar, and my son is, you know, he's just playing Roblox all day, or he's on, you know, Minecraft all day. He's not impressive as the next Caesar. So what they would do is, among their armies, if they had a trusted soldier who's proven himself, who's come up through the ranks, who's proven his loyalty, they could take him as a son. They could actually not basically make him a son. And sometimes the son taken, see, you didn't get to choose the genetic makeup of your own child. They came out the way they came out. You couldn't pick their height or their strength or their ability. You couldn't do that. But the Caesar can pick a soldier whose intelligence he likes, his ability he likes. He likes those things. And he hand-picks someone. And that's called not having a son, but actually what? Taking a son. Now this is important because by extension, through some of these literary terms, they made their way into Christianity on a side note. And in the Quran, you've got some Christian views claiming God had a son. And other ayat of the Quran describe, they say Allah has taken a son. Right? And having a son and taking a son were two different concepts actually. And they existed from Roman times. So some were even saying, no, it's not that blasphemous. We're not saying he had a son. We're just saying he took a son. And the Quran says, no, that's shirk too. That's not, no. Subhanahu. Ballahu ma fis samawati wa kullu lahu qanitun. You know, they're all subservient to him. So, but the reason I'm bringing this up is, when this minister finds this kid, he's maybe, you know, it seems that they couldn't have a child of their own, this couple, right? And they don't have a kid. So he doesn't have a succession plan. And politicians are thinking about how they're going to pass on their legacy. Yeah, that's what he's thinking. And especially in the time of the pharaohs, legacies are only passed on to your sons. You know, that's how legacy or your name carries on.
And now he sees we don't have a kid, and here you have this kid who's mature. We don't have to do the raising part. He's not a baby. We don't have to feed him or care for him. And the manners are already there. The intelligence is already there. The looks are already there. The refined, you know, personality is already there. Everything seems to be right. We, you know, this might work out as my succession plan, possibly. He's becoming really optimistic about this find of his that he's purchased. So he's telling her, honor his residence as if, you know, he's like a treasure to be honored, not a servant, not a slave. And so he says, honor his residence. And then he tells her why, and she must have been surprised too, like, what do you mean honor? I mean, we have a dozen slaves. We treat them like dogs. Why do you have to honor him? And so he actually explains his rationale, and he says, عَسَىٰ أَن يَنْفَعَنَا. It's hoped, or it's a good possibility, that he'll be of benefit to us. Now what this could mean, that he'll be of benefit to us, could mean, yeah, he'll turn out to be a really good slave, but all the slaves are of benefit. So here, he might be of benefit to us, is a little more than he's going to cook food for us, or he's going to do the dishes, or he's going to do the vacuuming, or clean up, or take care of the animals. It seems he sees a benefit coming from this slave that he doesn't see in other slaves. Because it's too natural, it's obvious. It's stating the obvious when you say, I got a slave so he can work for us and benefit us. He's not stating the obvious. He's going a step further. He's saying, I see a potential of him benefiting us in ways that I haven't seen any of our slaves. So I'm telling you, we're going to treat him different. You're going to treat him different. عَسَىٰ أَن يَنْفَعَنَا. So he's the object of the man of the house's attention. The man of the house looks up to him already, even as a child, even though he haven't even proven himself yet. It can also mean that as he grows in our service, I think that we will be able to lean on him in ways we're not able to lean on other slaves. Because, you know, when you give somebody a task, you can only give it, you know, to the extent of their ability. You know, if they don't know how to handle something, you can't give them that. You can't give a four-year-old a butcher knife and say, cut the meat. Right? So they'll cut the meat, but it won't be the meat on the thing. Right? So you can't give tasks beyond somebody's capacity. Now, if he sees a really talented, intelligent young man, he's thinking, wow, I might be able to trust him with some pretty heavy tasks later on. And right now, those heavy tasks, they're way too high level for me to give to any servant who's beyond, they're not capable of doing that stuff. And then when I do find qualified help to do that kind of work, I can't trust them. Because when if you have highly skilled labor, then you don't know where their loyalties lie, right? Because they know their skill is in high demand. So he's thinking, we can groom him into someone who can really benefit this household. And what that tells you is, there's going to be some sort of a mentorship program where this minister, maybe he's the finance minister, maybe he's in charge of the police, maybe he's in charge of the municipality, but he's a politician. He has some kind of authority. And he wants Yusuf alayhi salam in on these meetings, and he wants him to know what's going on, because he's going to put more and more tasks on him. And he's going to say, hey Yusuf, I need you to go there, keep an eye, I want you to know what those people are talking about when you go there, what are their servants talking about, I need to have a good understanding of what's going on. And he knows Yusuf alayhi salam is smart enough to analyze those conversations that are happening in different places. He also knows Yusuf alayhi salam is smart enough to pick up on things, and he might even, when he gets to a certain age, say, hey Yusuf, so you were in the meeting too, what do you think? Because you need a sounding board, right? You need someone you can trust, and you can't have those high-level classified conversations with anybody except you completely trust them. So he's already seeing all that potential play out in front of him, and he says that to his wife, عَسَىٰ أَن يَنْفَعَنَا. I'm pretty hopeful that he'll be beneficial to us. You know, when we get to the end of this section of the story, we'll go back to the biblical comparison. But one thing I'll tell you even from now, in the Bible, he trusts him so much that nothing in the house happens without Yusuf's permission. Joseph is basically in charge of everything that's happening in the house. He's basically handed the keys to the castle. Done. Delegating. Because I know you can handle it. You're that good. And then he says, now notice the next phrase, أَوْ نَتَّخِذَهُ وَلَدًا. Or we could take him as a child. We could take him as a son. Now what does that mean? We could take him as a son. Remember the choice made of, I handpicked a son? Well, if he proves himself and keeps on benefiting me, back in the day, you know, nowadays you have like somebody who gets a job as an intern, then they get upgraded to full-time position, then they might get to assistant manager, then they might get to manager, then they might get to regional director, then et cetera, and eventually VP, right? Maybe be a shareholder. They could move up to partner even. That can happen. They can move up to partner. There's a progression. Well, it seems in the ancient world, if you were a servant like this one, but you proved yourself, maybe one of the great progressions, one of the great upgrades or promotions is, you know what, I'm considering you part of this household. I'm officially now declaring you a son. I'm taking you as a son. أَوْ نَتَّخِذَهُ وَلَدًا. So it's not necessarily that there's two options. He's maybe even possibly thinking that the future may be that I consider him my own child. Let's see how this plays out. But I'm optimistic. Again, he doesn't know the future, so he's cautiously optimistic. But he sees potential here. Right? So this is the case that he makes to his wife. Now, obviously for Yusuf alayhi salam to be upgraded to the point where he might even be considered a son would mean that he's basically taken the reins of all the responsibility that this minister does, and he's become his right-hand man, and basically things don't run without him. Things can't run, function the way without him. You know? So, you know, it's like Alfred and Batman kind of thing. He's just running things. He's got everything taken care of. That's what he's hoping for. And some people are like, astaghfirullah. Some people are like, what's Batman? I'm Islamic. I don't know what that means. That's okay. You just make wudu again. Okay. Now, now Allah will intervene. This was the conversation the husband had with the wife, this brief conversation. That's enough. Now look, وَكَذَلِكَ. And that is how, now Allah is commenting, and that is how, مَكَّنَّا لِيُوسُفَ, we created stable housing and we stationed and installed, embedded Yusuf. We created an environment where he could remain stable. That's what we did for him. مَكَّنَّا لِيُوسُفَ. Now, that the word that is how is important. What is that is how referring to? That is how could refer to he saw a dream. His dad told him not to tell the dream. His brothers plotted against him anyway. They pulled him away from their dad. They put him in a well. He went through slave trade after slave trade after slave trade. And he ended up being bought by this man who then came and had this conversation with his wife. And that is how we provided this housing for Yusuf. Meaning, because you know, like, if you have steps that go to the second floor, and step one is how we got to step two, and step two is how we got to step three, and step three to step four, and at the top of the 20 steps, you can say, and that is how you get to the top of the stairs. So he's looking at all the steps before and saying, and that is how. And that is how. Or he's referring to this final step, this conversation, meaning the husband, the man of the house, has made sure that Yusuf will not be mistreated and he will have the highest opportunity. Now look at what Allah is going to say. Why does Allah want him in this house? Why is he in this house? You know, we skip over some of these details in this story, but they're so pivotal. They're so important. Because without them, the story doesn't move forward in the way that we would expect. We just think, oh, he was there, and then messed up stuff happened, and then he was in jail. No, wait, hold on. This particular episode is so important that it could have just ended at, he came to the house, the master told the man told the wife, we're going to keep him here, honor his residence, treat him respectfully, he might be of benefit to us, or we might take him as a child, and that's it, done. We can move on to the next episode. But we're not even halfway through this ayah. We're not even halfway through this ayah. Now, listen to the rest of this ayah. I'll translate the rest of this ayah. The rest of this ayah is not the story. The rest of this ayah is Allah's comment on this episode of the story. Yeah? Now, this is Allah commenting on this episode. Listen to this. كَذَلِكَ مَكَّنَّا لِيُوسُفَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. That is how we intended or we settled Yusuf down in the land. Which land, by the way? Egypt. وَلِنُعَلِّمَهُ مِنْ تَأْوِيلِ الْأَحَدِيثِ. And we did so in order that we teach him all kinds of speech, from all kinds of speech. Has all kinds of speech come up already before? Yeah, when Yaqub told him, Allah will teach you all kinds of speech. Now we'll have to come back to that one. So Allah says, I put him in this house, one, to give him stability in the land. مَكَّنَّهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ. مَكَّنَّ لِيُوسُفَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. Then to teach him from all kinds of speech. وَاللَّهُ غَالِبٌ عَلَىٰ أَمْرِهِ. And Allah was overseeing and dominant. Allah was overwhelmingly dominant and watchful over all of his situation. It can also mean Allah is the only one in control of his own decisions. Meaning Allah decides this. Nobody else does.
وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. However, most people don't even know. This is the commentary on that one little conversation. It's not even a separate ayah. It's one ayah. We don't separate the ayat until Allah separates them for us. So in a sense, it's one divine teaching. It's not separate teachings, it's one teaching. And until you understand the whole thing in connection, you might miss the point. I might miss the point. So what is the point? Let's go through this a little bit. So he's been settled in the land. He's a servant there. He's a servant there, but not just a servant. It seems like he's the minister's right-hand man. And he trusts him so much that he's going to bring him in on high-level classified meetings. Do you think other servants get to be in those meetings? No. Other servants don't get to be in those meetings. He's, even though he's an honored servant, because he's an honored servant and even the master looks up to him, other servants also look up to him. They talk to him. And he's the center of attention inside that house. And people, if the master trusts him enough for his advice, other people are coming, hey, I have this issue, can you give me some advice? I have this issue, can you give me some advice? And he's embedded, he knows the world of the servants. He knows the how the household works. He knows how the woman of the house is not on the same page as the man of the house. He understands how that works too. They live two different lives. He knows what his job is like on the outside and what kind of role he plays in public. And who are the other politicians that he deals with. He knows what people say and what they actually mean behind what they say. Because he sees the public and the private. And he's doing all of this while anybody else who was in this conversation and that conversation might get kicked out. Hey, you don't belong here. Get out of here. Right? So if you're from the wealthy and you try to hang out with the poor, they say, what, you forgot the way to your neighborhood? You in the wrong neighborhood, man. They're not going to open up to you because you don't belong among them. There's a mistrust of the wealthy. And the wealthy, when they see the poor, they are guarded like they don't belong among our circle. We're not going to open up to them. But he's embedded. And deeply embedded, installed even. Makkanna. Tamkeen means to have stability. He's stably installed in these different social settings and circles and in these conversations. And Allah says, and I did that for him so that we may teach him from the interpretation of all kinds of speech. What that means is, he's going to see people talking and then later on he's going to see how that plays out. So he's not just going to hear speech. He's going to see speech and he's going to see action. Then he's going to see speech, then he's going to see events. And he's going to try to learn to figure out when people say this, this is what they do. They say A, but they do B. Oh, this news means this, this, and this. You know, like for example, sometimes there's indirect connections. So for, you know, sometimes for example, there's COVID-19 situation, there's no travel, there's economy shut down or whatever. And then somebody makes a projection that some scientist or doctor or whatever makes a projection, that in 6 months it's all over. And if somebody makes such a projection, investors are like, when it opens in 6 months, what's going to happen to the airline industry? What's going to happen to the hotel industry? What's going to happen to the restaurant industry? I should invest in these industries or do this, because there's a timeline. But the doctor didn't say that, or the specialist didn't say that. He just said things might subside. They say one thing, but behind it maybe some other economic or political or other social realities, right? So the idea being, when he is going to see these different worlds and how things play out, he will hear something and know, first of all, which kinds of people have double talk. And even when they don't have double talk, what could be the implications of what's being said here. So Allah is teaching him the interpretation of dreams, but you can tell clearly right now dreams have no relevance. So the tafsir that ta'wilul hadith is only referring to dreams doesn't add up if you look at this ayah and the placement of this ayah. The placement of this ayah is he's just been situated, embedded in a minister's house where he's going to get to hear all kinds of conversations. And he's going to have the intelligence and the mentorship to be able to figure out all of those conversations. But you know, here's the most beautiful part of all this. Allah is telling us he's teaching him this. Allah is teaching him this. But we said that the mentor is actually who? The Egyptian minister. So technically, it's the Egyptian minister teaching him this interpretation and this analysis and giving him this educational opportunity, if you will. But Allah takes credit away from the Egyptian minister and takes it himself. Yes? What this is telling us is that sometimes we learn things about how the world works. Maybe somebody learns how the world of finance works,
or the world of politics works, or the world of sociology works, or they get a, you know, they study at the university, or they work in government, or they work in, or they're a social worker or whatever, and they've been exposed to learning about a certain world, certain kinds of behavior, certain sciences. And we think of these as secular sciences. These are not religious sciences, these are secular sciences. When you think of something that Allah teaches, you think of Quran, you think of Hadith, you think of, you know, the spiritual realities. But he's not learning something spiritual from the minister. He's learning politics, he's learning economics, he's learning, you know, backtalk and how that works. He's learning how to deal with scheming people. He's learning how to deal with con artists, because politicians have to deal with all of those, right? He's learning how to deal with all these secular worlds, these un-Islamic sort of worlds of education. And what does Allah do? He tells us that all of those worlds are also Allah teaching. وَلِنُعَلِّمَهُ مِنْ تَأْوِيلِ الْحَدِيثِ. This is important because sometimes young, zealous young people come to me and say, I want to study Islam, I don't want to study dunya, I just want the akhirah. That's great. That's awesome. Here's something from the Quran because you really want to learn it. هُوَ الَّذِي جَعَلَكُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَاسْتَعْمَرَكُمْ فِيهَا. He's the one who put you in the earth and he wanted you to develop on it. Develop the earth with what? حَلَقَات. Those are important too. But roads have to get developed, water infrastructure has to get developed, policies and procedures have to get developed, medicine has to get developed, hospitals has to get developed. That's also deen. That's also something Allah taught. Allah Azza wa Jalla taught Adam alayhi salam the names of all things. So our view of what Allah teaches is so restricted sometimes. We think that scripture, the word of Allah, is the only thing Allah taught. No, these are the ayat of Allah. But creation is also called ayat of Allah. There are ayat of Allah in them, right? They're also called ayat. And He's teaching them. There's other places in the Quran where Allah does this. Like for example, people who dictate contracts, right? We call them lawyers nowadays. Lawyers. Or people that in the world of finance that can draw up a contract, a loan agreement, a contract. I don't know if you get a more secular document than a loan agreement or a contract. And Allah says, فَلْيَكْتُبْ بِمَّا عَلَّمَهُ اللَّهُ. He should write from what Allah taught him. Wait, Allah taught the Prophet ﷺ Quran, and now Allah is saying, Allah taught this man how to write, you know, financial contracts. Allah took that credit himself. Why? Because Allah is telling us knowledge that benefits people, knowledge of how the world works, knowledge of what can benefit you yourself, is actually also knowledge that Allah taught. All knowledge is sacred. Just like all language is sacred, because language itself is actually something Allah revealed. عَلَّمَهُ الْبَيَانِ. And that's a very powerful reality that that's being brought to our attention here. The knowledge of the world and how it works. Sometimes Allah puts you in a situation that only you could have handled, right? And there are sometimes plans Allah has for people that, you know, maybe later on in their life they become Muslim. But before they became Muslim, they were in a crazy different world. They were in an Egyptian palace of their own with some crazy lady. They were in some crazy life. And Allah was teaching them something. In that life, He was teaching them things that they could never have learned in Tajweed class. They could never have learned those things at Jum'ah. They could never have learned them. But now that they've learned them, then Allah brought them to Islam. Now they're able to help people that they understand in ways other people don't understand. They understand certain realities other people have only known about, they've never experienced, they've never lived. Experience is a teacher, and the teacher behind that experience is Allah Azza wa Jal. وَنُعَلِّمَهُ مِنْ تَأْوِيلِ الْحَدِيثِ. Allah says, and that's why we put him in Egypt. So we could teach him these things. By the way, I'm getting ahead of myself, just so you appreciate how this works in the Quran. You know, a couple of years later, he's going to get out of jail and he's going to say, make me the finance minister. Yeah? Yusuf alayhi salam is going to say, put me in charge of the treasury. That's what he's going to say from his own mouth. And then he's going to say, why? And one of the reasons he's going to say is that he is alim. He's knowledgeable. I know how to handle this. Where did he get that education? In jail? Where did he get that education? In the well? Where does he come to the conclusion, I can handle the treasury of Egypt in this kingdom because my dad told me I'll interpret dreams? Where is he getting that knowledge from? It's when he was living in this house in the mentorship of a governor who was actually bringing him in on all the meetings, and he was learning to the point where he was even advising the governor, and he says, listen, I have experience in this, I know what I'm doing. I can prove it to you. That became his resume. This became his resume. What is Allah teaching us through that? Sometimes Allah will bring you to a very unfavorable situation from one point of view. He has been severed from his family. He is the victim of slavery. He is being treated with injustice. He is just a child, abandoned. But it may be that when he severs you from one favorable situation, the new situation you find yourself in may have a lot of negatives, but the positives, you may not be able to see the positives yet. They may be coming. They may be on the way. Like, Allah decides how these plans work. We can't possibly contain them in our human limited logic. We can only see that far ahead. You know, like in the East Coast, many highways, like in Jersey, for example, in the Turnpike or LIE on Long Island or something, when you're driving on the highway, there's trees on both sides. You can only see so far. And there's a bend, you can only see so far. Right? So your driving is going to be, you know, if you were thinking about speeding, you don't know if there's a state trooper around the bend. So you're going to have taqwa of, you know, New York state law, and you're going to stay within the speed limit because you don't know if there's a cop around the corner. But if there's a straight highway and you can see all the way through, desert on both sides, you're like, this is good. I got this. And it's going downhill. It's not even going uphill, so your view is limited. It's going downhill. So you got miles ahead you can see. You can go a little crazy. I don't recommend it. But what I'm saying to you is Allah has a view that we don't have. We only see, oh my God, this child got put in slavery. Oh my God, now he's severed from home. He's in this different place. Allah put him there for certain things that had to happen. And maybe this one family, this one father's tears. I'm breaking a lot of, you know, I'm giving you a lot of spoilers today. But that one father's tears, who's going blind in tears, maybe Allah had him go through those tears so that this child can get the kind of education Allah wants him to have, not just a spiritual one. He already has a spiritual education from his father. But he needs a certain kind of worldly education too that can only be provided from the inner echelon of upper Egyptian society. He cannot get that education anywhere else. And then eventually it's going to be his spiritual knowledge, which is interpretation of dreams, and his worldly knowledge, which is how to handle an economy. Both, that is going to lead to the saving of Egypt. And as a result of that, all the people on all the villages that are running out of food are going to have food to eat. So one father's crying, but if this didn't happen, there would be a million fathers crying and mothers crying for the starved death of their children. And all of that got avoided because Allah wanted them to have a two-pronged education. And now we're learning also the value of education. There's a spiritual education in our religion, and Allah also values for us worldly education. How does the world work? How does the economy work? How do politics work? How many of us are actually investing into our children for them to learn things like political science, anthropology, sociology, psychology? How does humanity work? How do people function? If he's interpreting how people speak, isn't that a psychological analysis? If he's interpreting how politicians work, isn't that sociology, economics, and politics, political science? And we'd rather just create factory workers, you know? Factory workers means the only reason you get an education is so you can have a job. Now, you can get a higher education and get a higher paying job, which means the tools you use are more advanced, and the words you use are more advanced, and the things you work on are more advanced, but at the end of the day, you're still doing mechanical work. You're still doing, it's just labor. It's skilled labor, and then it's specialized labor, and then it's highly specialized labor. Great. But the thinkers in society, the people, the movers and shakers in society, they're the ones who understand how people function, how people work. Where the ummah has to understand how these two worlds of education come together. We've separated these two worlds. When somebody studies religion, they know nothing about the world. No, astaghfirullah, that's the kafir knowledge. Really, kafir knowledge? What planet are you living on? Knowledge is a gift from Allah. Architecture is a gift from Allah. Clothing itself was a gift from Allah. أَنزَلْنَا عَلَيْكُمْ لِبَاسًا يُوَارِ سَوْآتِكُمْ وَرِيشًا. The ability to make armor for Dawud alayhi salam was a gift sent from Allah. That he could weave armor. Which means engineering, you know, carpentry, sciences, medicine. You name the field. You name the area of study, the study of history. You know, political science, psychology, sociology. These are gifts sent from Allah. And we should be at the top of these sciences along with studying the spiritual. What is this? And I know that this is digressing, but it's important because it came up in this way. Science and knowledge of the world is blind. Please understand that. Science is blind. You can use science to make the most powerful medicine, and you can use science to make chemical weapons. Same science. It's same chemistry, same study of biology. You can make lethal viruses, pun not intended, or you can make medication. You can save people. Same science, same scientist. They can go both ways. Because science itself doesn't have a moral direction. The spiritual knowledge that Allah has revealed to us, what does it give us? A straight path, right? When you have a straight path, then the knowledge of this world will only be used that is in line with that straight path. When you don't have the straight path, that same knowledge of science, architecture, you know, medicine, history, you name it, whatever science it is, it's going to be used in every direction, evil directions. But when we have the guidance with it, then it goes in the straight path. That's the relationship between revealed knowledge and what you call secular knowledge. They're both actually sacred. But one gives direction to the other. One gives purpose to the other. And without the other, just the first one becomes purposeless. You can have a PhD, but it's purposeless. What did you do with it? You know, you can have the highest sciences, but they're purposeless because they're using to destroy humanity instead of bettering it. You know, making the world a worse place. We're also learning here that our deen, one of the most beautiful surahs of the Quran, is concerned with the well-being of a nation for its akhirah and also its dunya. لَأَكَلُوا مِنْ فَوْقِهِمْ وَمِنْ تَحْتِ أَرْجُلِهِمْ Allah said, had they established the Torah and the Injil, Allah says about the people of the book, had they lived by Torah and Injil, they would have eaten from above them and from under their feet. That's what Allah, meaning they would have had the best dunya and they would have had the best akhirah. And some people, Muslims, have this concept, this our deen is only about the akhirah. We don't care about this dunya is haram, fitna, kufr. Really? And why does Allah want you to be grateful in this dunya? What are you grateful for? Haram, fitna, kufr? That's what you thank Allah for? You know? Why did He make this world the way that He did? So we can make the most of it. So we can use it for good. And build our akhirah from the hasana that's already inside of this dunya. Anyway, I digress too far. Let's come back to Wallahu ghalibun ala amrihi and wrap up our study of this ayah. And Allah, then He says, so we taught Him all manner of speech, and He says, Wallahu ghalibun ala amrihi. Two meanings of this ayah. One meaning is, and Allah was overseeing His matter, meaning Yusuf alayhi salam's career. Meaning every step that was happening, whether you think he was being abandoned or not, being beat or not, being abused or not, and he was going through those things, Allah was still ghalib, dominant, watching over. Like Allah is there. As he's being pushed down, as he's being shoved into a dark well, Allah is telling Himself, you'll be telling him about this soon. But they have no idea. It's at the same, this thing is happening at the same time. You know, as he's being sold into slavery, Allah is there. As he's being brought into this house, Allah is there. But you know what? When bad things happen to people, you know what the first thing they say is? Where's Allah? Why wasn't Allah there for me when I was going through this, 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 and this? It's like He abandoned me. Allah told His Prophet ﷺ, مَا وَدَّعَكَ رَبُّكَ Your master did not say goodbye to you. وَمَا قَلَى And He didn't abandon. He's not upset with you. And here you find Allah says about Yusuf ﷺ, no matter what he was going through, Allah was overseeing all of it. Wallahu ghalibun ala amrihi. There's a contrast that the Quran draws. There are two names of Allah in this surah, and they are in two different places. But I want you to pay attention to that. Even if I don't bring it up, you should have it in your mind as we study the surah. One name of Allah is ghalib, dominant, overseeing. And the other name of Allah is latif, which means barely noticeable, subtle. Barely noticeable. So they seem like opposites. If someone's overwhelming and overbearing and dominant, then you see their presence right there. Like if there's a dominant police presence, you could see them on the streets, you could see the lights, you could hear the sirens. That's a dominant presence. If there's a subtle presence, where are they? I can't find them. It's too subtle. You get it? Allah is both. For our eyes, He's latif. We don't see. For our hearts, He's ghalib, you see? And He wants us to see the world both eyes. Just like there are two kinds of knowledge, spiritual knowledge and worldly knowledge. Same way, the presence of Allah. To the naked eye, where is He? I don't see how this is working. I don't see how this is part of the plan. And the heart tells you, no, Allah is ghalib over His decision. Wallahu ghalibun ala amrihi. And the other meaning of Wallahu ghalibun ala amrihi is and Allah is in charge of his own decisions. Allah is, and that also implies to Amrihi, the Ha in the Amrihi can go back to Allah or to Yusuf alayhi salam. Right? So if it goes back to Allah Azza wa Jal, it means Allah is in charge or he is dominant over his own decision. Meaning, nobody gets to tell Allah, why did you put him in Egypt? Why did you separate him from his family? Why did you... فَعَالُ لِمَا يُرِيدُ. He does what he wants. He's in charge of what he does. He gets to make the plan. This is وَاللَّهُ غَالِبٌ عَلَىٰ أَمْرِهِ. It also means, غَالِب means to have the power to do so. Meaning, Allah had the power to rescue him whenever he wanted. Allah had the power to crush his enemies whenever he wanted. Yusuf alayhi's brothers' hearts could have started beating before they even laid a hand on him. He controls those hands, he controls those hearts. Allah, and don't think Allah is incapable. Allah is completely in dominant control over every decision that he makes. So just because you think, according to your plan, Allah is absent, don't you dare think that way. Allah is dominant over his plan. And in Allah teaching us this part of the story, he's teaching us something about all of our stories. Allah is telling us that no matter what someone goes through, Allahu ghalibun ala amrihi. And particularly for Yusuf alayhi salam, there's something special, a special meaning here that's specific to Yusuf. Because everything in the ayah is about Yusuf. So there's something special about Yusuf and his relationship with Allah here. And that is helped by the last phrase of the ayah, وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. However, most people, they don't have a clue. They don't know. Meaning, in general, it could mean most people don't know how Allah is dominant in their life. What dominant role? They don't even realize what steps Allah is having them take to help them. They don't recognize it. But in the case of Yusuf alayhi salam, what he's also saying is most people don't even know around him. His brothers don't know that what destiny lies in front of him. The minister of Egypt or this minister who bought him, he has no knowledge who he's actually purchased. And how Allah is the one grooming him for a task higher than this household. And he's simply a pawn in Allah's larger plan. Even the minister is just a tool for a larger plan Allah has for Yusuf. But he doesn't know that. The minister doesn't know that. The minister's wife doesn't know that. The prisoners don't know that. The king doesn't know that. Nobody knows that. That's Allah in charge of his matter. So, وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. However, most people don't even know. But this last phrase, most people don't even know. Some of us also, took this last phrase and said, and this may be even referring to the audience of the Prophet ﷺ, which is beautiful. It's like the Quraysh don't even know. Like we're telling the story, and most people don't. Then most people don't know what? Not just most people don't know the story of Yusuf. Most people don't know how Allah is always overseeing the affairs of someone under oppression. Rasul ﷺ was in the year of oppression. He was in the year of sadness when the surah was revealed. And Allah was ghalib over his affair while the Quraysh were thinking, we finally got him. وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. However, most people don't even know. They don't even know how Allah's plan works. What they were doing was only setting the stage for what's coming in Medina. And what's in Medina is only setting the stage for what's coming back to Makkah. Right? There's a larger plan at play. And the same way Yusuf alayhi salam separated, now in a new home, and it's pretty remarkable that Allah settled him in Egypt for a time. And it was a difficult time still. It came with its own trials. And Rasulullah ﷺ is about to be separated from his brethren in Makkah. And he's going to be in Medina for a time. And it's going to come with its own fitna, but it's more settled than Makkah was. It has its own trials, it has its own difficulties, but it's new kinds of fitna. Yusuf ﷺ in his family, different kind of fitna. In Egypt, different kind of fitna. But at least for some time there's breathing room, just like for Rasulullah ﷺ in Medina, there's breathing room. Right? وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. However, most people, they have no knowledge whatsoever. So with that, inshallah ta'ala, I'll conclude today's dars. I know it's been a long one. بَارَكَ لِي وَلَكُمْ فِي الْقُرْآنِ الْحَكِيمِ وَنَفَعَنِي وَإِيَّاكُمْ بِالْآيَاتِ وَالذِّكْرِ الْحَكِيمِ. السَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ تَعَالَى وَبَرَكَاتُهُ. Wait for it. Okay.